Hi, this is Bill Teeple with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and our special guest today, John Stimson. And this is Icon Art Radio. One of the biggest blockages to the creative act and for the creative person is doubt. It can paralyze a person. If they go into the studio and doubt everything they do, they will never complete a project and they'll never show their work. On the other hand, speeding ahead like a speeding locomotive without looking back is likewise as big of a mistake. I always like to recommend to my students and to myself particularly, in fact, this is what I like to do, is wake up every morning and wonder about what I'm doing. Even ask the opposite, even try to create the opposite approach or the opposite concept to the concept that I'm putting forward that day. Because I believe that's a way that we can bring balance into what we do and that we can progress in an evolutionary fashion with what we're doing with our creative practices. I think John Stimson, in a way, represents in this town a very precious element. And a very precious element in the art world are those who will help us wonder and question and ask us to maybe look back and not keep the speeding train going forward towards wherever it thinks it's going. You can characterize your role in the society, in the community. I'll let you do that.
Thank you.
On the other hand, one thing I might say is that I think somebody has to ask the question, what has happened to art? What happened to art in the 20th century? And where do we stand today, and where do we want to go? And I think John is one of the people in this community that's asking that question. I think it's very precious, and I cherish it. So go ahead and say a word or two about yourself and how you see your role in the community as a creative person.
Okay. Going back to the 1960s, when I had a very unusual childhood and upbringing, I was raised with almost always an outsider's viewpoint. Our family was very unusual, and our worldview as a family tended to be outside of the mainstream America. First of all, we were on Cape Cod, which by itself is a little artificial territory. I grew up assuming that pretty much all of America was sort of like growing up on Cape Cod, but in fact, in 1966, when we drove across country as a family, I found that I was very provincial indeed, that the rest of America, first of all, was bigger and more diverse than I could possibly have imagined, and that also, it was frightening. This was in the 1960s, before there was any pollution control, and also when the country was, as you were saying, rushing headlong like a freight train into a future that it wanted desperately and yet really couldn't define itself. And so it was chaos. And that was just before, of course, the really bad political chaos of the late 1960s that then became more or less a battleground for politics and certainly for art. 1966 was pivotal, that era was pivotal, because that, according to a lot of art critics, it was the year of the death of art. Or 1964, 65 was the year of the death of art. And so that was right at the beginning of my becoming a sentient person. I was age, 6, 7, or 8 years old at the time. And my early experiences of art and of culture were of a very European, very intellectual variety, as opposed to the modernism and the commercialization of art that was happening very quickly in the 1960s. So I was careful not to develop a judgment in terms of the modern art scene being bad, but it was certainly fascinating. It was certainly fascinating because it included ideas that would not ordinarily come under the realm of art at all. Commercial packaging, psychedelic designs, that sort of thing, were simply beyond the scope of what I had considered to be the subject of art. But I've had to include those things because, in fact, they are, like it or not, they are a part of modern life. So my struggle has been to keep my identity, but then to include and validate the experiences of other people who have vastly different experiences and agendas. So my role as a reviewer of the arts is one of not so much judging art. I try to stay away from issues of taste, but when art and art shows move me to ask and answer questions, then I feel that this show is important. And the relative value of the art, the aesthetic value of the art, is of less importance than the fact that it raises questions and that it stirs people's imagination and minds, their intellects, to discuss things that connect to art and connect to art as a part of life, as an intrinsic part of life.
Well, it's interesting to look at art in that context, because one of the things I think we often overlook is the notion of art in the, not just in the recent decades, but you know, in the 19th and 20th centuries, or even from the Renaissance forward, is very different from art in other cultures and art in prior millennia. And we kind of assume that the artist is a role that society has, but it's really only a role that certain societies have, and you have to ask the question, what is art in a society that doesn't have artists? It doesn't have someone who is called an artist. You have people who make rugs. Is that an art or a craft or a, you know? And so the whole notion of defining art has to be done, I think, ultimately in a cultural context.
I think actually that the closer to the point is that we are a culture that tends to separate art from life, whereas mm-hmm. other cultures do not.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you mentioned about the critics of today, specifically Arthur C. Danto and Donald Cuspid, have both talked about the end of art with the beginning of what we refer to now as the postmodern period. Mm-hmm. And it's not that people will stop being creative, but there was a certain paradigm that was in effect from the late Gothic period and the early Renaissance through the around 1960, mm-hmm. where there was a realm described that was the realm of art, and we talked about artists as unique characters, and that you could be an artist and be designated an artist and be given a kind of like political carte blanche in a way just by being an artist. That if we remove that whole mystique and that packaging and left a person to be actually responsible for the effects of his creative acts alone without sort of like cradling them within some kind of safe zone of art, I think we're coming to a change now. I think we're in a place where that is going to be more the case.
And there have been artists through the decades and centuries who have wanted to make that crossover, like Fernand Léger is one person, French artist, who very much, he would notice that when he walked by a store window, let's say, or when he walked through a factory that was making machine parts, sometimes he would have that experience that you, John, were describing, where he was very moved by the beauty or the patterns or something visual that he saw in those everyday situations. And he tried to take his art into that realm and paint things that were like, you know, glorifying machine parts and all that. And he also was very concerned with bridging the gap between artisans and fine artists, because why do we make that distinction anyway? Why is the weaver of a gorgeous rug or a potter who paints beautiful designs on pots less of a worthy artist than somebody who paints paintings that hang in galleries isolated from ordinary everyday life? So I think those are questions that are we need to address in this whole context too.
We could do several shows here. Yes. Because it comes down to a question of value, an intrinsic value over some kind of celebrity value or even in secondary market investment kind of situation that's apart from the art world altogether, where these things are a way of traders to make money trading these commodities.
I think the word environment comes up, where in agrarian and third world countries where primarily there are people who are connected with the land, their art would reflect more the laws of what we call nature. Whereas we are very much a social society, and nature as such has been pushed into the background of the culture's vision, such that our environment is people. And the artists then still have the role of exploring nature, but it is human nature and the nature of society as opposed to the nature of plants and animals.
Well, and with postmodernism, it's really in a in a context of stuff.
Stuff. Yes.
It's like, mm-hmm. You know, art that's an observation on stuff.
Right.
There aren't even people in it.
The environment of the supermarket.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or I'll never forget from art in the 21st century. This, I'm probably misremembering it, but the spectacular samurai, you know, armor installation made out of credit cards, and it's visually stunning, and it's, you know, technically an achievement.
And it's ironic.
And it's ironic, and it has, you know, various commentaries, you know, below the surface, and yet at the same time, it's utterly heartless. And, you know, it doesn't appear to reflect the kinds of things that the prior generations, and I think immediately future generations, are actually considering to be key ingredients in art.
Nurturing.
Well, yeah, or, you know, discovery and
well, the postmodern period, if we think of it as after the end of art, is almost like a house of mirrors reflecting all this stuff you're talking about. Everything that's happened in the 20th century in the realm of the human psyche being expressed in art, human interaction, and then we are so overloaded with imagery. This is one of the themes of postmodern art. Is that now we no longer refer to anything that's real. We're just referring again to all of this layers of imagery, which are copies of copies of copies, and so reflecting on copies. And then the art world being made up of this has, in the postmodern period, has been, since we have no real direction, is this sort of like floundering around in the looking, rehashing it all, and it's just, it really is like a house of mirrors, and nobody's asking, like, really, where's the end? Let me say this. Postmodernism, one of the definitions of postmodernism is the rejection of an end game, the rejection of any kind of final truth,
the questioning
of absolute truth at the end of the game, which was, I believe, the whole thrust of the progress of art history up until 1960. But now the postmodern period has been a reaction to that. They say everything is relative. Well, when everything is relative, it opens the gate to the pluralism we have today, which sort of says anything goes because everything is relative.
There are artists, I think, though, today that are very conscious of at least trying in their conceptual pieces to represent exactly what you were just saying, the frustration and the dilemma and the confusion and all these questions. And they try to put that into their piece of art so that when you look at it, it actually is very moving in a poignant way, because you look at that piece and you hear like what the artist was attempting to say in that piece. And there's something very moving about even trying to do that.
Well,
it's like a step one.
Absolutely. The only way I've been able to deal with this, and people probably have seen the way I am dealing with this, the only way I can deal with the situation is to take it on a case-by-case basis mm-hmm. and to look for heart.
Exactly, yes.
In each piece. In other words, each artist is myself, the one, trying to find him herself via his activity in life. And the artwork is this like altar place. Making art in the studio is this altar place where an offering is made towards truth. And that is the essential bottom line of art making. And so what I see today, and it actually, you know, I'm sorry you didn't see the Matthew Barney. We're gonna have to see, because it's really the epitome of Matthew Barney, in a way, is the epitome of the postmodern situation. At the same time, he's making a very interesting comment, because these pieces, these movies that he makes, are called Drawing Restraint. And there's this sort of like arbitrary goal he set at the end of this thing, which is like to make a drawing. And he creates this situation where he's all strapped up in straps and springs and things. So he has to grapple towards this spot where he's making this drawing. And just when he makes a line, he's pulled back and thrown back. And then he has to grapple forward again. So many people think he's like a self-indulgent sort of like manufactured superstar of the art world, which he is, there are some significant statements he's making in his work. So you have to sort of figure that we're all in the middle of this sort of Matthew Barney setup, where it's like these incredibly distorted boundaries, and we're kind of grope towards some kind of meaning and truth at the end of the game. And I give the poor soul the benefit of the doubt. And in the context of what he's trying to do, I try to see through his eyes and see the heart and the beauty that he's groping towards. And if he even gets there a little bit, I'm pretty happy, actually. And I pat him on the back and say, good boy. And that's kind of the way I work. My discriminating powers are such that if I wanted to, I could pull the rug out as an act from under it all, because I'm a neo-Dadaist from San Francisco, essentially, what I come out of, mm-hmm. which is what we did. I've kind of swung the other way, and I've gotten kind of more just good try about things.
Well, one of the things that we have lost in the sort of potpourri approach of postmodernism is refinement.
Yeah.
Because traditional art is something that can be refined, because everyone knows the context. Whereas the current context is trying to come up with something no one has ever seen before. And if you do, they will like you in New York.
Right.
Yeah. And if
you should have seen that Matthew Barney.
I know, I was
that
sorry
was
to miss
exactly
it.
That was exactly what they said. The curators and stuff said, this is something new that's never
been
seen.
Yes, something new. and the thing is, when something new comes along, it doesn't get refined exclusively by that one person. If it has lasting value, someone else will do something based on that, or will do the very same thing in a slightly different way. And we used to watch, through the eye of history, we can see things evolving very steadily and in relatively gradual ways. But now, if someone does something beautiful, someone else looking for something to do will say, well, cross that one off. I can't do that.
It's like poetry that rhymes.
Yeah,
it's
I can't. Anathema. Can't well, I write poetry that rhymes.
Of course. But what I'm saying though is that the critics of poetry quite often will dismiss poetry that rhymes simply for the fact that it rhymes.
Yeah.
And contrary to your approach, Bill, which is attaboy, pat him on the back, I have a slightly more outsider approach to it, which is, well, everybody really, if they were honest with each other, with themselves and each other, everybody could do better than they're doing.
Yeah, and I obviously I'm working from one angle and you're working from another. I think our goals are the same.
Yes,
because I do then, after patting them, say, but are you revealing what you want to reveal?
Right.
You know, ask them the questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as a reviewer, which is a, I often sign my name with the initials SPA, self-proclaimed authority, because I have no credentials per se, but let's just say that my reviews are another form of art. It is an art response to art, and so I like to make the review be a piece of art that is contextual. That is to say, it refers to other art, but it itself has to have the integrity of art by itself. So there would be no place in a review of mine simply to slam something or dismiss it, but to be honest about my response to the art and also to present discussion and arguments to support my view. And then quite dramatically, I have heard responses to my responses. That is to say, people come up to me and say that they have read my review, and whether or not they like the review, they thought it important and that it raises questions that we should all be actively thinking about and discussing.
I've always wondered why it has to be called criticism. Mm-hmm. An art critic instead of commentary. You know, it's like, why is it called a review and a criticism instead of just someone's commentary on that work of art? And that, it seems like that's a much broader name for it.
It's because of the devolution of the word criticism.
Yes, it's true.
Criticism used to mean essentially a commentary based on evaluation.
But it has a specific quality of being analytical, almost surgical, in a way where, without actually destroying what you're looking at, you want to reveal structures that are not obvious on first viewing.
Mm-hmm. People tend to, upon reading, I mean, I know I even do, if I'm reading reviews of shows in galleries in New York or films or plays or whatever, if the person sounds intelligent, it does influence me and make me either want to see that or not see that. And I think, and sometimes I've just been completely fooled by reading somebody's review of something, and then later I've seen the art or the play or heard the album or something like that, and I absolutely loved it and didn't agree with the reviewer at all. But before, it took me a while to come around to even be willing to go in and have my own reaction to it, because people who write these things and publish them in newspapers and magazines influence people more strongly than they probably should in this culture, I think.
Yeah, a lot of people are looking for what's supposed to be good instead of looking at what's there.
But the people wanting a sense of being cultured without seriously taking on the role or the mission of culturing themselves.
Yeah,
well, I always like the Reader's Digest myself. I don't have to really read the book.
Yeah, and the other side of this is that, again, it's kind of inevitable side effect of postmodernism, that given the random nature of the contemporary art tradition, where new is more important than improved, to use a horrible pair of words, it means that people do need a guide. They need some sort of, you know, help picking what, you know, what's worth looking at and what what's worth exploring, if shall we say. And that doesn't apply in Fairfield, where everyone can see every piece of art in town every week if they want without a great deal of effort.
But even seeing it every week, like when we have the gallery walks where the artists are talking about what they're trying to do in their work, you can see the work many times up to that point, and then when you hear the artist talking about it, you see much more deeply what's going on there. And to, I mean, what I would like is to have art reviews and art criticism do more of that, like give you an insight into the artist's process in getting to that point, so that when you go to see the work, you don't feel so blind, you know, and just, am I supposed to like this or not? Instead, it's more like, oh, I can see if he's coming from here, right. I can see how he got there.
Well, I think the most important thing is to do whatever you can to get inside the eyes of the artist and feel what he felt when he made it as well as you can without being the artist. Because he's got many different motivations, but ideally his motivation is to give you a gift of what he loves. And if you can get screw yourself, your head on, in the same way that his head is screwed on about this stuff, because obviously his whole world is built around it, then you can appreciate what's there.
I think the combination of the artist, the reviewer, critic, whatever, and then the audience, the combination of all three gauges the ultimate importance of the art, where if the artist creates with integrity, the reviewer thinks about and writes about, and then the audience then comes to appreciate that we have a fulfillment. So the ultimate goal of it is to create fulfillment.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.